This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Just a warning, this interview discusses violent homophobic attacks and some extremist ideology. Horrifying vision has emerged of gay and bisexual teenage boys being brutally bashed in Sydney, beaten unconscious while their attackers reportedly invoked Islamic State. It's confronting, it's disturbing, and it forces a serious question. Are we looking at random violence or a signal of extremist movements regaining traction here in Australia? Well, Associate Professor Josh Roos from Deakin University studies political extremism and radicalisation, was consulted during the ABC investigation into these attacks. Josh, welcome to Drive.
Good afternoon.
From your research into extremism, what patterns are visible in these Sydney attacks?
Well, for a prolonged period of time, at least the last half decade, if not longer, we've seen an emerging ideological convergence between extremist groups in terms of, you know, who they identify as the enemy. And so we're seeing this across the spectrum, the extreme right, Christian nationalists, Islamists, so Salafi jihadists, and conspiracy theorists, amongst others. And in their world, not only are we seeing like a significant increase in their anti-Semitism, they see Jews as behind the, you know, scenes pulling the strings, but they also view LGBTQA+ community members as responsible for the moral decay of society. And they view them through this lens of morality, but also as effectively subhuman. And so we've seen that playing out online. There's an enormous amount of hate being directed towards these different groups. But critically here, we saw this play out with young men in their teens who were associated with hate preachers in Sydney from the extremes of the Muslim community.
What is it about the young people that makes them more vulnerable to this extremism?
Well, in this world, in particular for young men who are looking for not only sort of status and standing, but to prove themselves as tough, these narratives offer them, you know, all of those things. They offer them power, they offer them a sense of meaning and purpose, and strength. And really, the hate preachers know exactly how to calibrate and target young men with these messages. Now, in this world, particularly in the context of Islamic State, which we all know for the period in which it was in power, for about 2014 to about 17, was, you know, targeting LGBTQIA+ members, threw them off buildings, and has constantly expressed hate, and we know that there's been terror attacks overseas linked to the group. We've seen cheerleaders for that movement and people actively seeking to build that movement here in Australia. And so they've got a group of young men, some of whom have family members associated with the Islamic State, who've carried out these really heinous crimes, luring young men through social media.
You mentioned the word that they see LGBTQIA+ people as being subhuman as such. Is that view of the community resulting in more violent behaviour? That the fact that they're detaching, the human, I suppose, from the community?
Yeah, one of the critical elements of violence is, particularly political violence, is dehumanisation. To frame your enemy as less than human in some way, shape, or form, to strip them of their not only humanity but their personhood, to deny them the right to live in the first place, and so they view the world through this lens of through their morality and through what they perceive the world and how the world should be structured, and in their world, they view it LGBTQIA+ communities as evil. They view them as less than human and deserving, and we've seen hate preachers push this of punishment by death. And so there's a critical issue here where there's members of religious communities out there preaching that members of LGBTQIA+ communities should be put to death. Now, that hasn't been shut down, either in person or online. It continues to persist, and it continues to drive some young men into that orbit.
Why is it that it hasn't been shut down? What's stopping it?
There's a number of issues. These individuals are very good at skirting the law. They know what the law is about hate speech, and they know how to calibrate their messaging publicly and what they're posting online to maybe just avoid it. So they might not frame it as themselves advocating it, but they might say that this is what the Quran, for example, advocates. And so you're then starting to look at freedom of religion, and you're starting to open up a bigger sort of Pandora's box of what's acceptable, which is, you know, challenging not only to establish but to also prosecute. Now, the ECAJ actually successfully took on one of these hate preachers last year for hate speech in a civil case. And, you know, it's coming down to individuals and community groups having to do so, because our authorities are not equipped, A, with the necessary legislation, but B, with the resources to undertake these investigations, particularly online.
Let's talk about the violence that happened in Sydney. What indicators told us that this was ideologically driven rather than just some sort of spontaneous violence?
Yeah, so unfortunately, I mean, I asked to see the footage because you can't make a thorough assessment without it. And there was some, you know, pretty horrific footage. The key elements here were Arabic sayings related to Islamic State, but also like Islamic State symbols that popped up in one video in the corner of the video. Whether or not that was homemade, that's beside the point, because Islamic State isn't a hierarchical organisation that steers and guides every single local chapter internationally. It operates through inspiration. It's stochastic. People aspire to live out its ideals and its teachings. And so what we've seen is, in the local context, these young men drawing direct inspiration from the movement and from its theology and from its ideas, and then acting in accordance with that. The probably most concerning element of this, having seen the videos, was the extent of familiarity and just how comfortable these young men were with extremes of violence, including continuing to assault people once they're unconscious, and the fact that they were framing it very, very clearly through a religious lens and a lens of hate towards these gay young men.
Well, are we seeing an increase in this violence at the moment?
It's difficult to quantify, because in many cases people don't come forward, particularly young men who are in, you know, quite a precarious position in that they may not necessarily have come out to their families or anything like that, and who are, you know, 16, 17, who may not want to go to police and make a statement. The journalist who worked on that case estimated there were significantly more cases based on his conversations with police that have never come to light. And at least one of those videos, those individuals have never been prosecuted. So it's likely, but we just don't have a precise number.
We're chatting with Associate Professor Josh Roos from Deakin University and discussing the violent attacks on LGBTQIA plus teens in Sydney and what that may signal about extremist movements in Australia. I'd love to hear from you as well. Do you feel safer or less safe as an LGBTQIA plus person in Australia right now? 0427 569 949. Josh, do you think that historical distrust between LGBTQIA plus communities and law enforcement has affected the amount of reporting that is done?
Look, I would hypothesise that is the case. I've been to numerous, I've given talks and numerous training engagements and so on with various community members and groups over the last sort of 3 or 4 years in particular. And it is very evident at all of these meetings, including where Victoria Police, their liaison officers, for example, I'm in Victoria, that there is a history of distrust. Mm. And, you know, arguably for good reason, given, you know, the historic precedents that were set. However, I think there's probably a pretty good attempt, at least from what I see from these liaison officers, to engage. and to engage in a far more equitable and accessible manner. But I think the lingering distrust, particularly for older members of the communities, will continue to persist potentially for the rest of their lives, given how bad it was at one point. I think there's still a lot of work to be done.
What? How do we stop people? What needs to be done to stop people from being sort of radicalised into this thinking that people from the LGBTQIA plus community, or any other community for that matter, are subhuman? What do we need to do? What does the government need to do?
Oh, it's a multi-layered problem. On the one hand, going after these influencers that are spreading hate online and hate preachers is an important element, but you're effectively treating a symptom of a larger problem here, which is a wider societal discourse that's been shaped by politicians seeking to exploit issues for political gain, right through to a lack of education in our schools and in wider society. And this comes back to just the basics of respect and recognition for people who are different, or people who have different experiences and have a different set of like values. Like, you've just got to basically go back to the basics of citizenship that we're not teaching in our schools, where you do respect others and where you are capable of overcoming your own narrow prejudices to treat others as human. And it's our common humanity that's being lost in all of this. And that sound, at the risk of sounding like a motherhood statement, that is critical in what we're teaching our young people. We've got to do more.
And what about for members of the LGBTQIA plus community? What can we do to try and prevent this?
I don't want to, pretend to understand the challenges faced safety, but one key element is, for example, understanding that apps, particularly apps where users are anonymous, do bring dangers, and that's across the board. And in this case, we saw a Yap app used to really target young men who were lured to these locations and said, quite discreet locations, and then assaulted brutally. So these young men hadn't told anyone where they were going. They didn't have any sort of security or backup mechanism. So it's pretty risky behaviour at the best of times, let alone where that was the end state. So I'd say safety on apps, particularly around anonymity, and also critically, again, engaging with police, engaging with government about the need to police this online and to take action. And really, one key question is, what was the role of the apps in this? How did they facilitate this? Can they be held to account for some of this?
Josh, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you. That was Associate Professor Josh Roos from Deakin University.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.